So everyone's seen my title by now. I was actually originally wanted to talk to people and chose the topic really to be a discussion. So I wasn't thinking of such a large group, but I was planning on choosing a subject that would be good discussion for people here, and it hopefully will be. Basically, what I've always been interested in is really what's how neurons communicate and what their signals mean. And since there's been a lot of good work in this field recently, I've been taking a particular tack to try to kind of simplify the question a little bit and really kind of focus on what a neuron does. And there's mechanistic ways to talk about the problem, and there's also the kind of black box ways. And really, the way you think about the black box can be a number of ways. And really, I'm just trying to link stimulus to response. And this is mostly appropriate for sensory neurons, although the discussion could range farther. And there's really two kind of functional links between stimulus and response that people have traditionally used over the many years. And one is tuning curves, and the other is receptive fields. And I can just describe both of these now if you're not familiar with them. Basically, a tuning curve is, and I've talked to a lot of you about this subject. It's a very simple description of a neuron where you might have a stimulus dimension, such as maybe an angle of the orientation of a bar of light. As you vary this stimulus, you can look at the neuron's firing rate. And it's a tuning curve kind of traces out the firing rate as a function of the stimulus parameter. Very simple measure. And really, you could imagine way back in the day before people knew what neurons did at all, you could be recording from a visual neuron and you just show its stimuli until it fires. And so this is essentially mapping out what causes the neuron to fire. Really a modern version, but really coming from the same idea of a tuning curve is a receptive field. And I've shown a spatial receptive field here, but usually these days, you're not really worth anything unless you're talking about spatiotemporal. So this is just two dimensions, when in fact a full visual stimulus would have three dimensions. And what this shows is the area of visual space that a neuron responds to, mapped out, in this case, by white noise stimuli. And you can see it responds most to an area like this. And there's actually you can't really make out an inhibitory surround. And this, a lot of people know, would be a LGN or retinal ganglion cell neuron. Basically, these are two descriptions of really how a neuron takes stimulus to response at varying levels of complexity and been used throughout neuroscience for a long time. And what I'm interested in doing is thinking about them in the context of the fact that neurons are communicating information. Information being a really abstract quantity to some, but something that you can really clearly define.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just as an outsider, can you clarify that statement that you're not worth anything unless you're spatiotemporal?
Yeah.
I just want to know what kind of stuff I should learn. Maybe I shouldn't learn.
Yeah, it's really that, I mean, that's not quite true, and you can actually do a lot of things by just looking at the spatial representation of a neuron, but you almost implicitly have to look at its temporal response. So you can look at the spatial representation of what a neuron's responding to at a particular latency. And the thing is, you almost have to keep track of its temporal response. And so now with computers being able to keep track of
To what
so many
extent
dimensions.
Can you study spatial and temporal separately?
You can. It might not always be valid. And they talk about space-time separability, where you could actually have a spatiotemporal receptive field, which would be a function of, say, two dimensions of space and one of time. And you might be able to express it as a function of just space multiplied by a function of time. And something that I didn't mention, but I decided kind of while I was doing this talk that I originally wanted to present these two ideas, both tuning curves and receptive fields. I have ideas on both of these. But I think I'm going to just stick it to the first one, especially since we have such a large group and we could really delve into this instead of going to both. So I'm still left this up there because I'd love to talk to people about spatiotemporal receptive fields and information, but I think that'll wait for another time, so we can talk about it more later. But really, I mean, I was kind of being blasé about it, but just the spatial receptive field is an interesting object. But since typically nowadays when you study the spatial receptive fields, you also intrinsically have a dynamic component as well. You do them all at once. But both of these...
I mean, just as a historical remark, I mean, the people who first noticed center and surround in the retina, they also noticed that the dynamics of center and surround were different. So in fact, retinal ganglion cells don't have... I mean, you can correlate things with white noise, you do all you want, and if you think about it, just because of the circuitry, the path from photoreceptors to ganglion cells is different when you go straight through and when you go around. It takes different amounts of time. So it's not only, there was apparently a period in which you were allowed to forget about this, but.
I should also mention nowadays, now I'm coming into this field rather late, but I basically, if I want to calculate a neuron's receptive field, the kind of data I have automatically gives me the spatiotemporal receptive field. And so I don't even have to worry about whether it's space-time separable or not. It's not even a question I worry about. It's calculated however it is. There's, of course, many assumptions that go into both calculating receptive field and certainly a lot more going into Turing curves. But I think there's some value to talk about these more simple representations of a direct link between stimulus and response in the context of information encoding. And the problem I'm going to really spend a lot of time today is looking just at the tuning curve, where I'm really dropping my stimulus space to maybe one dimension, and really talking about, even if I have such a simple representation of a neuron's link between stimulus and response, there's actually some interesting information issues lurking in there. And just before, because I always forget at the end, the work that I'm going to be talking about and the work I'm not going to be talking about are done with these two collaborators. And in particular, the good advantage is the work I'm not going to be talking about is with Garrett Stanley, who's going to be here in a couple weeks. So if I don't have a chance to talk to you guys about it, he will. And also, this is a discussion. Please keep in mind, this is for discussion. I hope you guys chime in. But some of the stuff I even made last night and hinges on a tenuous understanding of things like Fisher information. So correct me if you think I got something wrong and all that. But it should be a good discussion. Anyway, so I'm going to just jump into the tuning curve thing.
Since it's a discussion, when you make, say, link information measure to function, you want to find the measure which is represents closest to the function that you think the neuron is accomplishing? Or what do you mean by link the two?
Well, it actually means slightly different things in both of those contexts. But in this case, I'll very clearly explain it in a second. So in this case, I want to really ask a particular problem in terms of linking a neural function to information and so on. And this is just going back to the almost canonical example of tuning curves in the visual system, which is Schubel and Wiesel's experiment where they discovered the visual cortex of mammals responds to oriented bars of light. In particular, V1 simple cells are mapped out here, where you present a certain bar of light, and depending on the orientation of light, the particular cell you're recording from might fire a few spikes, might fire many spikes, and you can plot out the number of spikes it fires in a given given time window as a function of the angle of the bar. And they plotted out this tuning curve, and you can see it. The cell responded most strongly to the peak, and then 90 degrees off, it didn't really respond at all.
So Dan, you might want to throw in the idea here that you're collapsing the time domain by taking a mean firing rate and plotting that. Right?
Yeah. So I'm ignoring kind of dynamics.
So the pattern of spikes that you see in time will not be taken away.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention, but this is the time axis, and this is when the stimulus was on, and stimulus was off and off, and you can see, you just do the total number of counts in this particular window. You know, I don't know. I assume it was on the order of half a second, but I mean like on the order of not 10 times more, not 10 times less. Anyone know?
But this means that in one trial, you count essentially something like 5 spikes per second or 10 spikes per second.
Yeah, on that order, maybe it can get up to 30. I actually.
This is data, you don't count.
What?
This is data, so you count like.
Oh, yeah, we can count them. Yeah. That's a good point. Feel free to chime in like that. This is your kind of canonical example of a tuning curve, but I've never actually read this paper even, which is embarrassing. But what I want to say about this, that the tuning curve is really a very like basic way, like this is what the neuron does, right? In fact, Hubel and Weasel, the story goes, they were playing all sorts of slides to this anesthetized cat when they were doing this experiment, and they couldn't get this neuron to fire at all. And finally, they realized like the neuron was actually firing when the slide was changing. I don't know if there's some variation of this story, because it could be myth. But the bar of the slide, it was an old-style slide projector without PowerPoint, and the bar of the slide would actually drive the neuron to spike because it was an oriented bar. And so they're like, aha, we've discovered what the neuron responds to. This is the tuning curve, and the neuron responds to this this peak of the tuning curve. And so even though this is 1959, to this day, people still use the same sort of understanding what V1 neurons do. And this is a beautiful picture, which you might have seen in a lot of neuroscience covers, of a map of the visual cortex using a technique called intrinsic imaging. And what it does is you present oriented bars to a neuron while you're imaging from the surface of the cortex, and you can tell through a kind of mystical way, which we could go into, but it doesn't have anything to do with my talk, basically what area of the cortex is responding most strongly to a particular orientation. So you can map out the entire visual cortex, or at least this section you see here, based on the orientation that you respond most strongly to.
How many neurons are in each patch?
Whew. That's
just a rough number for me. It's thousands?
Tens of thousands, I'd say. I think it's safe to say there's about...
It's 100,000 neurons per square millimeter. The width of one of those uniformly colored blobs is probably about a millimeter.
Yeah.
But you change by 10 degrees in one a 20th of a millimeter.
Is color part of the stimulus?
No. No, it's just an oriented. That's purely for false color.
I think this picture is probably 10 millimeters across.
Hubert told me that a week ago. So if you change it by 10 degrees
in the
20th of So
the point is, this is a beautiful experiment that's been done everywhere. I think I got this off the cover of some journal, actually. It might bring up good memories or bad memories to you, or none at all. But the fact is people still use this idea of a tuning curve, even describing V1 neurons. And implicitly, by the way, the tuning curve, they call it a kind of tuning curve in some sense because it's what the neuron, you're showing what the neuron is tuned to. So in contrast, a lot of people have thought a lot about tuning curves. And in particular, I clipped this from Abbott and Diane, is if you look at a tuning curve and think about what the neuron's conveying information about, one of the first thing that pops into people's head is actually the stimulus that the neuron is, quote, tuned to, actually at this stimulus, the neuron's response is very insensitive to changes in the stimulus, which means actually you'd have a hard time figuring out whether, based on the neural response, which stimulus the neuron's actually talking about. In other words, which orientation. And there's a lot of people who have studied this in detail, and I'll talk a little bit more about this at the end, but you can do something like a Fisher information. The formula given below, not to confuse people, but I threw it up there in case we need to go back to it. But the Fisher information actually is related to a bound on how well you can decode the stimulus. And it's actually even zero at the tuning curve peak. And actually, it says that kind of the stimuli where you presumably you could encode the best are near the point of maximum slope, where the response changes the most as a function of the stimulus parameter.
Does this assume a noise model?
Yes. Yes. In fact, this I'm glad you asked. For the experts, this is kind of a general expression for Fisher information, and if you make all the appropriate assumptions to make things almost as simple as possible, you actually get this much simpler expression where f of theta is the actual tuning curve, and f prime is just the derivative of the tuning curve. So some assumptions that went into that is that there's some of them are unrealistic, but we'll talk about this later because I go through this calculation at the end. But basically, one assumption is that you have uniform Gaussian noise that doesn't depend on the stimulus.
Is this a single neuron response, and this is information about the stimulus given the response?
So this is Fisher information, which is defined in this particular way, which I'll go into at the end.
The question is this information about the stimulus given the response?
It's
evident what response.
It's related to if I were to present a particular stimulus and look at the responses, how well would I be able to guess the stimulus? What would be my error? It's related to that in some cases. But I put this up at this point as a straw man because what I was talking about was, well, a neuron's tuned for the stimulus at the peak, and now we have another view that it's actually tuned to encode stimuli that are off the peak. And this measure isn't supposed to clarify things at all. I'm actually going to introduce a measure that hopefully will. Yeah, Ben.
What's that straw man?
Oh, it's something that I'm going to eventually tear up, or what do you do with straw men, burn? Yeah, it's kind of like a voodoo sort of thing that you can poke at, especially if it ends up being true. It's basically, we got two perspectives, and to get to the bottom of the perspective, I'm going to basically, I phrase the question well, which is that you have a tuning curve, and we now don't know what stimuli the tuning curve is actually representing best. And actually, intuitively, you might feel that the answer actually would depend on some of the assumptions that go into my plot of the tuning curve. For example, how noisy is the neuron? How variable is the response? So if I had a very noisy neuron, then actually a high firing rate might actually stand out the most, and that actually might encode the best stimuli. If there was very low noise, if the neuron was precise, then I could just very easily decode, kind of map exactly whatever the response was and get a stimulus. So it actually might depend. And really what I'm asking is for a definition of what it means to be well encoded. So I've brought up these possibilities, and that really, you could say that in one case, when it's at the peak, you got spikes conveying information, stimuli that make the neuron fire the most. The other sense, there might be some sort of mapping between stimulus and response, which doesn't have to necessarily do with information of a particular spike, but has to do with some other coding structure. And the way we can answer this is by going into what it really means to be well encoded as a stimulus. So I'm going to come back to the tuning curve problem. This is the last tuning curve I think you'll see for a little while. And I'm going to just talk about what it means to be well encoded as a stimulus.
Before you move on, I was impressed by how symmetric these curves are. So is it wrong? I mean, I tend to think of the neuron as an amorphous blob. That's wrong. I mean, the neuron clearly knows the direction.
Yeah, these.
There's strong left-right symmetry. Is that well understood, the symmetry? Symmetric is very high accuracy.
Well. So it does depend on your system. So a lot of tuning curves you see will be symmetric, and
there are non-symmetric ones as well.
I think so. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there's even if you did a tuning curve
in. The classic example is tuning in the auditory system.
Tuning in the auditory system.
you measure firing rate as a function of, if you just play a single tone and measure firing rate as a function of the frequency, that's extremely asymmetric.
Also, hippocampal phase field, long phase
That's nowhere near
it. It has long phase field, shape low frequency, and very sharp decay on the high frequency side.
Yeah, and there's examples. I mean, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. So now I'm going to back up and really talk about kind of, a lot of people throw around Shannon mutual information, which I love. But really, I just wanted to talk about what it means to be well encoded, and I want to back up so that I can talk about this without really necessarily having a model of what the neuron is actually doing. I basically want to look for the most general description, but I put model independence in quotes because what I am assuming, and I want to make this clear, is that there's a joint probability distribution that you measure between stimulus, which I have, I'm going to be using these interchangeably because I borrowed these slides from different talks. I'm going to have stimulus theta or S and response R. Basically, when you're looking at a complicated set of stimuli, a complicated neural response, you have to make some assumptions in order to discretize what a stimulus is and what a response is. And so of course, that is model dependent. But to be fair, information theory can still compare different models where you discretize it differently. But for the sake of discussion today, I want to pretend that I've got the right model, or at least a good model, such that I can list the relationship between stimulus and response as a joint probability distribution. Does everyone know that? Joint probability distribution? Just the probability that I'd see a pair, stimulus and response, particular pair. And I always like thinking of it as kind of a black box in some sense. So the idea is that actually, why wouldn't you just stop at the joint probability distribution? Because it would tell you everything there is to know about the structure between stimulus and response. And there's two answers to that. The first answer is that you could actually, I'm not going to show you today, but you can actually have a huge number of stimuli and a huge number of responses. And so this joint probability distribution would be extremely complicated and exhaustive to even list out or print out or plot. That's one reason. And so it's very useful to have measures that summarize the joint probability distribution in particular ways. And the other thing is, even when you have a simple joint probability distribution, and I'll show you an example. This is kind of plotted in false color as 3D, but this is an example joint probability distribution for a tuning curve, where you can see the kind of basic shape of the tuning curve with the noise around it. Even in this case, as I've said, it's still unclear really what a well-encoded stimulus is.
So your key contains noise.
Yeah, that was what the tuning curves I was showing you was the average firing rate as a function of the stimulus.
No, previous slides, this key parts data contains noise.
Yeah, it's really if you present, one way to think about it is if you present the same stimulus multiple times, you can plot out the responses. And so if there's some variability between stimulus and response, then you would have actually a distribution of responses as a function of stimuli. And you could reverse it and say, actually, for a given response, there's actually a multiple number of stimuli, I look for it.
Tuning curve doesn't look like this, right? Because the only thing you can do in a fixed time window is count spikes. So you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's discrete R, right?
It does look like this, but again, sometimes you get 1, sometimes you get 2.
As we saw before, we have something like 10 distributions.
There's a
problem.
It's not an average. There's a probability that
you're going to get one. No, but I think this one's easy. So the average, of course, can take on fractional values, and that's fine. But he's showing you the joint distribution. So presumably, if you really think the response is the number of spikes, so rate is not a response of the neuron, right? Neurons don't respond to firing if they respond to spikes. So you can, if you count the spikes, then the verdict of y-axis is automatically discretized.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you decided to measure interspike intervals, then it wouldn't automatically be discretized. So.
But his question was about the tuning curve.
His question was not about.
Yeah, I think it, well, we can ask him what his question was. I guess the problem is that the problem is that here, right, if you make the bridge, you might have thought that this would automatically be discretized if you were counting the spikes.
And all I'll say is I'm really trying to talk about the generic tuning curve. And in this sense, I want to go back and assume that that however I did the joint probability distribution is going to work for now. If it isn't, let's talk about that later. But this is, but just so everyone knows, is on the same page, I'm kind of thinking, imagining I have a joint probability distribution. And I still, even though I have the whole description between the relationship between stimulus and response, I still have this ambiguity of what a well-encoded stimulus is. And I just mentioned down here that actually, in some sense, mutual information, or the measures I'm going to show you, are ways of simplifying or simplifying this relationship between stimulus and response. So is just a receptive field. All of these are maps between stimulus and response, some of them more abstract, some of them less abstract. And so
this simplification is for us, to better understand this picture. So this is, you think, how the brain will interpret this. What's the motivation?
Well, let's leave it at our brains will interpret this, and then maybe it's some discussion about how the brain actually uses tuning curves. I mean, all we can talk about is really what a neuron, I mean, we can talk about the mechanisms of a neuron, or we can talk about how it changes from stimulus to response. And so,
And you said that this is a simple case, and the complicated case would look like what, how would it look like?
Well, I don't know exactly. I mean, you could imagine, like when I was talking about receptive fields, is that you actually have a stimulus that's over three dimensions. Each dimension could be bins, so that a stimulus could have, you know, thousands to hundreds of thousands of components. And a response could be individual spikes, it could be a spike count, or it could be the precise timing within 100 milliseconds.
In this framework where you have just one dimensional response and one dimensional stimulus.
Yeah.
What else could this be?
What does, this is a representation of the joint probability distribution for a tuning curve. And,
You can see a sigmoid.
What? Oh, you mean you could see some other representations? Yeah, you could. Yeah. Yeah, in this case, this is a cosine tuning curve, and that's one example, but I guess you can see other functions as well. But this is very generic, I'd say. I just peeked ahead, but I got caught. So this is a definition of mutual information, and again, I'm using S and theta interchangeably. This is one of many ways of mathematically expressing it, but basically you can see you can take the joint probability distribution, calculate the marginal distributions, and use this formula to get to it. I'm going to talk about what this means, but in the meantime, if you feel that the whole idea is this would kind of give a single number that represents how much the stimulus and response depend on one another, What I was interested in today is talking about what stimuli are well encoded. So what I want to do is I want to kind of decompose the mutual information into quantities that are specific to a particular stimulus. In other words, so that I have the probability of a stimulus times some quantity I of s gives me the total mutual information. And intuitively, this is that if there's some total information which has to do with the relationship between stimulus and response, that each of these stimuli actually contributes some information to that.
I question your choice of notation. I don't like the letters I or S in this particular order.
The I right there?
No, I
or S. IR. Well, I tried to change them all to thetas, but I didn't quite make it all the way through.
I also have a question about notation. What's capital theta and capital R?
Yeah. So thanks for asking. What I'll be consistent with is this is just so there's individual instances which will have lowercase letters, and then there's the whole ensemble.
So
this is a sum over.
Abstract, okay.
Yeah. So these can be any random variables, but in particular, I'm going to be talking about stimulus and response, and that's actually going to be very important because the thing is mutual information, you can see I can interchange the r's and the thetas, and the formula remains exactly the same. But I'm talking about a decomposition into stimuli now. And similarly...
good question. In the example you showed, the joint probability distribution was highly peaked. That is, for a given stimulus, if you simply looked at the response curve, it's a single high peak. Do you ever see any... And if it is, and whether you take the peak value or the first moment or whatever for your tuning curve, doesn't matter too much. Do you ever see very different kinds of joint probability functions, double peaks or peculiar?
Yeah, I'd say you'd see the whole range. Is that the tuning curve is in some ways one of the simpler representations, and you could have multiple peaks. I'll show you an example later on where you just consider a visual neuron mm-hmm. that's responding with a receptive field response, and you'll see that, or you'll see some of the complexities of that. Anyway, the point is because I and because S and R are symmetric in the mutual information, you can kind of imagine that you can similarly just change all the R's to S's and vice versa and decompose things as a function of response. And so there's a question of how do you decompose the mutual information into kind of stimulus or response specific quantities. And this, the fact is this there's actually many ways to do this. That the functional form that you choose for I of S is actually not constrained to one possible functional form, which means that actually how you decompose the mutual information into stimulus or response specific quantities depends on what you want to mean by the information of a stimulus or the information of response. And this question was originally investigated by Deweese and Meister, and they discussed two possible decompositions, which I'm not going to go in. Well, I'm going to go into one of them here, but the one I'm going to go into is the specific information, because they decided this one was appropriate as a decomposition and that one wasn't, given what they wanted it to mean. So I'll tell you a little bit more about this specific information.
This small I of S can depend very strongly on what P of S is, right?
Oh yeah, it should be a function of some.
Yeah, so why is it useful to separate them this way?
So what I'm interested in is kind of talking about the information associated with a stimulus. And I want that to mean something like a stimulus with high information is well encoded. Stimulus with low information is not well encoded.
Yeah, but if that depends very strongly on the whole distribution, why focus on individual
stimuli? Well, I'll plot this for the whole distribution. I just want to ask a simple question, and the joint probability distribution doesn't necessarily answer the question. So I want a measure of the joint probability distribution that does.
But if I can comment on that question, in some sense that's not the point. If I give you the joint, P of S and P of R are fixed, they are the marginals. If I give you the joint, they are the turning. However, even P of S given the turning, because I gave you the joint and then you know the marginals, this decomposition is still not unique. There are many functions, little I of S, such as multiplied by P of S and sum over S, give you the mutual information. And then the question is, what is a reasonable choice? And what's a reasonable choice depends a little bit of your intuition or some heuristic notion of why would you like this I of S to measure? What do you mean by some stimulus being more informative than some other stimulus? So in some sense, this discussion of how to choose the I of S does not depend on P of S. For P of S given, you could choose I of S in different ways.
I want to pursue this question a bit further. I mean, again, why are you fixated on a single stimulus? Does this make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. In other words, the neurons encoding the whole ensemble.
Yeah, so mutual information, the techniques of mutual information work essentially on
right. So I want to apply it more specifically, because the mutual information in this context is just a number, and it means something. And you can compare it to other numbers that are measured in the correct way, and you can gain something out of this. What I want to gain out of it is really talk about the stimulus ensemble and talk about what are important symbols to the neuron and what are not important symbols to the neuron, and see if I can get at that in a kind of model independent way. So that's the idea. But it is a specific question. We have to realize, I mean, the thing is a visual neuron won't encode auditory stimuli. I mean, at least earlier in the cortex or in the visual pathway. It's useful for some people to know this, especially when you're talking about a functional description of a neuron.
Yeah, I don't think, maybe some of this discussion, there's a sort of historical context that's missing, which is that for many, many years, physiologists have labeled neurons by the location of the peak of the tuning curve. This is a neuron that's tuned to 30 degrees. And you could say, I mean, the example that you gave of, you know, calculating the Fisher information from the tuning curve, say, well, this notion that the neuron's tuned to 30 degrees is very misleading, right? Because if you wanted to distinguish 30 degrees from 32 degrees, this is actually not the neuron you should look at. And that's true. So you could say, oh, well, you know, this was a dumb idea to put these labels on the neurons. We're going to go off and do something else. The only problem is that people have actually found it really useful to put these labels on neurons, and the labels seem to form maps. And, you know, nearby neurons have near similar labels. And, you know, there's a whole phenomenology that's built up around this idea of attaching a label to a neuron that refers back to something in the space of stimuli. And the fact that it was done in a crude way, and it nonetheless, you know, helped organize the field, makes you want, and, you know, once you notice that it was crude and that it's in some sense not what you thought it meant, it's not unreasonable to ask if you could replace it with something else. So I think Dan's effort to try to find, you know, the best encoded stimulus, I mean, from the point, you know, the point that's being made here is that from the point of view of information theory, talking about the best encoded stimulus is a little weird, right? Because it has to depend on the distribution of stimuli and has to be context dependent and everything else. But there is this desire to attach a label to the neuron. The question is there a more rigorous way of doing it? This, by the way, is not an endorsement of what you're going to say later, because I don't know what you're going to say later.
Yeah.
It's an endorsement of the motivation. I think it's too glib to say, oh, these efforts to attach labels, well, you know, we shouldn't do that because we know it doesn't mean something. It does, because in fact, you know, they make maps, right? So the biology actually seems to care about something related to those labels.
Well, we could argue about whether maps have biological significance. It's a different story.
Yeah, that's for the discussion afterwards. But yeah, I mean, actually, so just if we can get by on the motivation, that's all I've presented so far. And actually, this is supposed to discuss whether you actually believe and want to endorse the content. So I'll try to give you some intuition for what I'm about to say, which is really hinging on one way of interpreting what mutual information actually means. And for those of you who don't know mutual information, I apologize for presenting it earlier without explaining this, but now I'm finally getting to kind of one interpretation of mutual information, which is that from the perspective of if you're watching a sensory neuron and you're trying to judge, so you're a little guy in the brain, you're trying to judge what's out in the stimulus world, you might have some prior knowledge of what stimuli could possibly be presented. This is an example. This is the prior distribution probability of stimuli without any knowledge from the neuron, but in this case it's uniform, so you had no prior knowledge of what the stimulus could be. And then what happens is a neural response comes along, in this case a firing rate or a number of spikes that comes in that is represented by the tuning curve. And so when you observe a response, that presumably tells you something if you're a smart homunculus, and it now tells you that the distribution of stimuli that could have been out there that led to the neural response has been reduced. And I've plotted a conditional distribution, P, of the probability of a stimulus given seeing this particular response. So in other words, I didn't know anything before, and now I know something. I don't know everything. I don't know exactly what stimulus is, but I know something. And so information, one way of interpreting mutual information is it's a measure of how much I learn by a response. And you can quantify that by using a measure of the uncertainty in a probability distribution. And one measure of uncertainty, which is very appropriate for probability distributions, is the entropy. And these are the formulas, which aren't so important, but basically it's quantifying they're very important, but I'm not going to talk about them too much. They're quantifying the uncertainty in these probability distributions. And so the whole idea is, I'm saying information is being conveyed because the uncertainty was reduced. So this quantity h of s, which is the entropy of the prior, minus h of s given r, entropy of the conditional, that quantity is what I'm going to call information, it's a reduction in uncertainty in the stimulus ensemble from a particular response. And what the mutual information is an average over all responses. So that's one interpretation of mutual information, the average reduction in uncertainty in the stimulus ensemble that you get from a single response.
You're trying to address the encoding problem, right?
Yes.
And you're calling this second line the encoding problem? How do you interpret the second line?
Well, so I actually got in a thorny discussion with Bruno right before he left about really what's encoding and what's decoding. And maybe I'm going to duck putting a label on it. What I really want to say is that I want to know, I mean, ultimately this is the relationship between two variables, S and R. It's symmetric, so I don't have to. It's kind of a measure of the relationship. I'm explicitly not trying to decode, although I'll try that at the end. So in that sense, maybe it's encoding and maybe it's something in between. But I'm really just looking at how much of the information, say, about the stimulus world is in the response. We can talk about that too. Once I get a little further. So anyway, that's the intuition for mutual information. And so then you can start saying, well, there's specific decompositions at work. And one obvious specific decomposition, given my interpretation, is this what's called the specific information by Deweese and Meister. And this is basically the entropy of the prior minus the entropy of the stimulus given a particular observation or response. So this is defined as the specific information of response. And intuitively, you average overall responses, you get the mutual information. And this is the information that you get from a particular response. So a response that doesn't tell you anything about the stimulus world doesn't have any specific information. A response that reduces your uncertainty a lot has a lot of information. Deweese and Meister actually were much more mathematical than I'm going to be. And they went on to prove that this is the only decomposition of mutual information that is additive. Or additive defined this way, which is intuitively a great quality of a measure of information. Of course, it's the decomposition of mutual information. So this doesn't answer my question, though, right? This is the specific information of response, which makes a lot of intuitive sense and has additional properties. The question is, can I use the same decomposition for stimuli and have it mean what I want to mean? And of course, by that, I just switch all the R's to S's. And just notice when, you can't notice on the screen because I don't have the general formula for mutual information up there. But in mutual information, I was exchanging capital R's with capital S's and little R's with little S's. To make these specific measures work, I have to switch capital R's with little S's and little S's with capital R's. So it's not necessarily, we wouldn't necessarily expect it to be a symmetric quantity, where what works for one works for the other. And in fact, it doesn't. And I'll illustrate that by a simple example. And this is a toy example that I think everyone can understand. And this is an example of, well, I thought a tuning curve was a simple joint probability distribution. This is even simpler. You just have two possible stimuli and two possible responses. And so that sum total adds to one. So the probability of seeing each pair is shown in the box. I've arranged it so, of course, I chose this joint probability distribution specifically, but the probability of seeing each response is equal. Does it make sense? So let's talk about which is the best encoded stimulus. Does anyone have any votes off the top?
Right-hand side.
What?
The right-hand side of your...
So that's a response.
Yeah.
So okay, so that's a good response, maybe.
Well, the fact that you can differentiate R2 S2 and R2 S1, where you can't differentiate R1 S1, R1 S2.
So which is the best stimulus? Because I like that.
He's telling you which one is the best response.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. But which is a question I also want to. We're gonna get. Yeah. But so here's the S's right here going across. Sorry if you can't see it back there. But I like that answer for a response. That's actually the response that turns out with the highest specific information. Mm-hmm. But we'll come back to that. So what about stimuli? Any opinions?
There's only one way you can get S2.
How?
R1.
So you like S2. Okay, any votes for S1? Okay. Well, yeah, well, there's a lot of undecided. Well, okay, that's good. But I was only pausing, not to really get responses, but maybe you guys see this, because I want you to believe me at the end of this slide. And if you don't, it's okay. But I would say basically, let me just point out my perspective again. And is that responses are giving information about the stimulus world. So I said there is an equal probability of measuring each response. And if the first response is measured, what do you know about the stimulus world? Nothing. You're actually kind of, this is a subtle point, but you know less than you did to begin with, because originally S1 and S2 were not didn't have uniform priors, and now all of a sudden you go to a point where it could be either one. But what happens if you measure R2? This is the informative response, remember. But if you measure R2, you know it's S1. So in fact, half the time you hear from this relatively simple neuron, you don't know anything. And the other half of the time, you know it's S1. Well, okay. You guys are taking advantage of the simple example, but I'll show you a much more complicated example where the same thing happens. Let's not think one step ahead. But yeah, it's true. But in this case, I mean, as soon as I know one, I know it's not the other. But if there was a couple more examples that look just like one or the other.
Well, even if you know R1, you still know something wrong, because the prior is not equal. Now you have chance to get S1 and S2, so the information is not there.
Well, let's just stick into the intuition.
Intuition is always wrong, but if you put in the calculation, the information is not zero.
It's actually negative. The specific information of R1 is negative. But I mean, in some sense, it gets more philosophical to say whether you actually learn something to learn that it could be anything. But in some sense, I really want to talk about it as reduction and uncertainty. And in such a case.
So since stimulus one is more likely, right?
It is in this example.
If I measure was 1/4 in R1, I should prefer stimulus one. So in that sense, stimulus one is better.
That's what I would say. I would say stimulus one is better, because half of the time you learn it's stimulus one. The other half of the time you don't know. Okay. I mean, I'm glad you guys are spending some time with this, because you got to buy this a little bit. I'll give you examples which follow these principles.
When you're saying something is encoded, well, now you're trying to give a definition about like a performance under the condition of S1 present or S2 present. I mean, there must be, right? You're saying when S1 is present, you know, when R2 is, when you get R2, you know it's S1. And then if you get R1, well, you know, it could be a quarter probability that's S1 or S2, but if you take into consideration the prior probabilities of S1 and S2, then you would still decide S1. And therefore now, so therefore, that based on this description, you're saying S1 is better, it's a better stimulus?
Well, I mean, literally it's, I'm going from intuition, and I'll get rigorous. But you're right, if I had to decide before I knew anything, whether it was S1 or S2, then I would decide probably S1, because it's more likely from the prior. But what information is it's a reduction in uncertainty. I'm basically less uncertain about S1 after a measurement than before. And that's what I mean.
So maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but it sounds like you're saying S1 is encoding better because it happens more frequently. But I would think
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the responses are equally likely. Half the time I learn that it's S1, half of the time I don't learn anything. So I'm just comparing whether I learn more about S1 or S2.
Here, in this example, it's very in this example, you have S2, which is 1/4 probability, and S1, which is 3/4 probability. So you really cannot say whether S1 is better encoded because it's better encoded,
yeah,
or because it just happens to be right. More open.
Specify
what you mean by better encoded.
Right. It's not a fair comparison. You know, the S1 has more chances at that. You know, go.
Let me see. Can anyone help me? Because the fact is I'm defining. I haven't given you a definition yet. I'm still trying to motivate the intuition. Someone mentioned it could be S2, because S2 always leads to a particular response. I'm suggesting that it's S1 because you're measuring the responses, and the responses tell you about something about the stimulus world. So it turns out that one response reduces my uncertainty completely about the stimulus world. The other response doesn't. And what does this response tell me? It tells me it's S1. These are the only two possible responses. There's no zero response.
It seems to me that there are two separate problems. Right? One problem is that you've given this table, and the other is that suppose you're not given this table, you're given the experimental data, you're supposed to figure out this table.
Well, so where I'm starting.
The neuron is whatever you call it, the little human guy in the brain. Is given this table or not?
Well, the human guy in the brain presumably knows it already.
Oh, the human guy knows it. So
yeah. His genes told him, or learning and memory, maybe some plasticity.
It's not figuring out this table.
So no. We're looking at a neuron. We've already measured this table from a neuron, and we're now trying to figure out what the neuron's encoding. And the question is, you know, I'm just trying to motivate an intuition for that it might be encoding S1 better than S2. Okay, let's move on. We can talk about this more. But this is the intuition I'm gonna kind of base things on. Let's look at the alternative intuition, which was to use the specific information.
Is it possible to construct a 2x2 example in which the stimulus S2 would lead to responses such that that those responses were always more likely to have been generated by S1?
Say that again.
Is it possible that the stimulus S2 would lead to responses which all had the probability, the majority of which had the feature that they were more likely to have been generated by S1?
I have not.
I think if the probabilities of the stimuli are sufficiently asymmetric, that's possible. So the reason I bring up this possibility is that when you talk about informativeness of stimuli, unlike the case of responses, right? There's an issue about metric in the space of stimuli. So you might want it to be true that a well-encoded stimulus is one such that if you look at the response, you're pretty sure that and not all the other things was the stimulus. Somehow you want to make that intuition precise. But of course, information theoretic quantities are permutation symmetric. So you might imagine that if you tried to write down an information theoretic quantity, you'd have the possibility there would be this highly informative stimulus that whenever it occurred, it generated a response that made you absolutely sure what the stimulus was, except it wasn't that stimulus, it was something else.
Yeah, and what I would say is
I don't know whether that's
good
or bad, right?
No. What I would say is that I actually tried. That would...
In illusions. You see one thing, then you're sure that it's another one.
Right.
So one would not conventionally refer to that as a well-encoded stimulus.
Yeah. This was kind of the white whale that I sought after to try to disprove this. Because that basically, if you believe this intuition, then that would be an example which would kind of very much attack the heart of this intuition. What I would say is that I could not find such an example. Certainly with 2x2s, you might have to go to many higher dimensions. But what's clear to me after looking at more and more examples of this happening in real things is that that will be typically a pathological case, I think. If you could get the joint probability distribution somewhere like that. And what I'm going to show you with a particular example is this is actually not a pathological case at all. This is a very likely case. So what this whole talk will miss is a mathematical rigor of proving that the definition, which I haven't given you yet, but it will miss the proving that the definition is the definition. But what the definition certainly gets at is this intuition, and it will give you reasonable results when you expect the answer a certain way. So that's all I can give you for this talk. But if someone comes along and gets at this intuition with a different measure, and I would love to see it. Actually, there's one other measure that gets close to this intuition, but it's not nice for other reasons. But so anyway, but here's the wrong measure, which is this specific information. So again, I was talking about the specific information of responses. You could try to apply it to stimuli, and look what happens. What this definition would say is that the information associated with a stimulus is proportional, or is how much it reduces your uncertainty about what the responses were. So initially, you could have had either response. When stimulus one is present, you're more likely to see, stimulus one is the bottom one, by the way, you're more likely to see the second response, which is actually relatively little information. And stimulus two reduces your uncertainty in what the response is completely. So this is kind of weird. So I was voting for stimulus one on the last slide, and this says the answer is stimulus two. And what's actually going on? So you can't use the same measure, not because either measure is wrong, but they're measuring different things. And what I've been talking about is an intuition about what information being conveyed is, where responses convey information about stimuli. So both of these definitions are fine, but one is telling you intuitively what you're looking for, and one isn't. And the whole idea is that if you can imagine a neuron mapping stimulus space to response space, in this case, S2 always maps you to R2, even though S1 can also map you to R2. So in other words, this has high specific information because it encodes few response, or it creates few responses. But really, the world we're living in is where this response is conveying information because it limits you to a few stimuli. Because this response could tell you either stimuli.
Yeah, for example, we're back to the question from 10 minutes ago. Why would you care about individual stimuli?
Okay, let's put that question off longer then.
One response would tell you a lot about the world, and the other would. I mean, that's essentially what you know.
Right. So you what you're saying is you care about which responses is significant, but you don't care about what stimuli.
Well, you care to know that some stimuli are more likely than others when you have the response.
That's exactly what you're
saying. Well, so
whether this particular stimulus is in some way better represented than.
I mean, I'm interested in which stimulus is better represented by the neuron. So let's. Yeah. Okay.
But there is another way to measure what stimulus, right? So you could apply string biasing inference and do the best estimate of what the stimulus is from responses, and then calculate the number of errors that you make based on this matter.
I'll get to that. That's good. So that's another measure. So I'm deriving an information, or a Shannon information-based quantity, and but that's another measure. We'll come back to that. So anyway, here I'm about to get to the definition, and so I'm saying that a well-encoded stimulus is one that's associated with informative responses. I told you what the information of response is, and the specific information of response is the reduction in uncertainty about the stimulus ensemble from a particular response. Mm-hmm. So in this worldview, what follows is the information of a stimulus, and I call it the stimulus-specific information (SSI), and it's basically the average reduction in uncertainty that you get from a response when you're presenting a particular stimulus. So what it is it's the information of the responses weighted by the responses that are associated with the stimulus. So same sort of intuition that goes into both of these. So that's the definition. And before I go back to the tuning curve example, which is a simpler example, I'll actually go to a more complicated example, but where we might have some intuition. Ooh, before I do the more complicated example, here's the toy example. The whole idea is, a guy pointed out over there, R1 is actually an ambiguous response. R2 is not an ambiguous response. And you can see the specific information of R1 and R2. The specific information of R1 is actually negative, because it increases your uncertainty about the stimulus world. Specific information of R2 is close to a bit. It's a very clear response.
Could you go back once?
Yeah, you want to see the definition again?
Yeah, but essentially, aren't you talking about decoding if you replace S with S hat, which is estimated stimulus, then this looks essentially like the rich information between stimulus and estimated stimulus.
I'm not replacing anything here, but if you're saying if I were to replace which one?
S by S hat.
S by S hat here.
You have then some great decoder that from your group R gives an estimate of the stimulus.
Uh-huh.
And then you look at the information between stimulus and estimated stimulus.
So actually, I'll talk about that a little later, but in some ways that's the mutual information between S and S hat. If your decoder, it doesn't even matter if it's a good decoder or a bad decoder, but as long as it's one-to-one, the mutual information will be the same. But it still might be very wrong as a decoder. But so I'm not going to address the decoding question yet, but I'll get to it. What I was saying is that you get a clear response, an ambiguous response, and then you got a neuron that's associated with an ambiguous response, so it actually has negative stimulus-specific information. And I'm sorry, you got a stimulus that has a negative stimulus-specific information. And then you've got a stimulus that has associated with a good response. But it's associated with, so actually, half the time you learn what the stimulus is, which is S1, and it's got 0.48 bits associated with it. So you see that this brings out my intuition. But of course, that's what we expected.
And this troubles me is you just said about the causality. So, in a causal way, in a physical world, how you can get this table? It doesn't make sense to me.
He said that you inherited from your parents. Is that a reasonable view?
Well,
I wanted to ask this question. Is that reasonable? It's sort of a orthogonal to your talk.
How do you
inherit that table from your parents?
Well, some you might have inherited, and others you might have learned. Basically, you hope the neuron, in some abstract sense, functions in the correct way. And what that essentially means is it maps the particular stimuli to the particular response.
System, right? You're talking about somebody in the brain who knows about this table. I thought you were saying before, you were talking about a single visual neuron, and then later you were talking about somebody in the brain that knows this table.
Well, so
a little guy.
Yeah, so I should draw a diagram. So there's the visual world.
Right.
I'll just put a tree in it. This might be an important thing to draw, though I don't know if I'm going to get this across. So there's the eye, and then there's a visual neuron.
There is no visual world.
Oh, the visual world is. Yeah, I thought you guys would contrast it. So there's the visual neuron right there. And then there's a little guy in the head. I forget if I think he's in the back of the head. And he sees the responses of the visual neuron. Mm-hmm. And so he can't see out of the, and see what the stimulus was, but he can see what the neural response is. So the question is how much information, and he's smart. He's a big head. Yeah. He can look at the responses over time, and he can quantify everything. And sometimes the ear will tell him whether he was, you know, what actually was in the visual world. So he knows the table, and he then knows some amount of information from the response, and that's some fraction of the information in the visual world. I think that's the logic, and that's the way of looking at it. That because, and this guy is basically, you make him as smart as possible. If he's as smart as possible, he's the ideal observer. He'll learn the most there is about the visual world, given the neural response. Mm-hmm. And a neuron in the brain might not be the ideal observer. Mm-hmm. But I'm not asking that question. I'm asking, given observing mm-hmm. this neuron, mm-hmm. if I was as smart as possible, how much would I learn?
I guess the question was, what is the control? I mean, this guy's very smart. The only thing it sees is this neuron, right? So he has to get controls.
He's smart because he knows his table.
Yeah.
But how does he know this table?
Yeah, well, that's something that Ela and other people are interested in, is how do neurons get their functionality? But in some sense, the functionality of a neuron is a mapping between its inputs and its outputs. And since all the neurons work, they somehow got it right. So I'm not interested in that question. But
so in reality, the ideal observer is us. So we're the guy doing the experiment. We know the answer to the experiment. We're looking at the neurons.
Yeah. So that's. So that's the idea. So the joint probability distribution we're saying is given. Ah, thanks. And so SSI works in the toy example. Now let's go to a kind of real. Do I want to say this again? I'm being pedantic, probably. Best encoded stimuli are those that lead to least ambiguous responses. This might not be your definition of what a best encoded stimulus is, but that's the definition I'm going to stick to. So I've hoped to motivate with intuition. And now let's look at a real example, which is a retinal ganglion cell. And this is from a model that of a visual neuron that produces realistic stimuli. It was a neuron paper that was called Predicting Every Spike. It basically, whether or not it fully reproduced all the important response properties of the visual neurons they were studying, it certainly made complicated responses that looked like visual neuron responses. So I'm using it as an example to generate a lot of data and to basically see what stimuli this neuron encodes.
Can you explain that?
I'm sorry. I should this is something that, again, I was going to get to with the receptive field thing, but this is a typical way that people have been measuring information in the early visual system, early meaning like retina or LGN before you get back to cortex, using full field flicker stimuli. And what full field flicker is the whole visual field is either on or off, or often a Gaussian random value with like 128 frames per second. And this drives the neuron to fire spikes. So in a given experimental trial, you would give this stimulus, and you'd get the neuron to spike at these times.
So the bright blocks are on.
Yeah. And you can do multiple repeats of this trial, and then use this for all sorts of things. And one thing you can see is how reliable a neuron's response is, and the timing jitter and such things.
That's in the rabbit?
This is a simulated neuron. It's simulated based on data from, I think this is like a cat retinal ganglion cell. So it's supposed to represent like your generic visual neuron for the purposes of this talk, but actually represents something very specific, and they have a whole paper on it. But so this is an example of and I should mention, I think this is an on-off cell temporally, so it responds best to stimuli at some latency when that it's bright and then dark. I'm sorry, dark and then bright.
Yeah, because dark to bright. Response at 200 milliseconds to a pretty bright stimulus.
Yeah, and so the question, I forget exactly the latency. I think the latency is something like 50 milliseconds or something. At any rate, the problem is the second half of my talk, which I'm not going to give you, talks about the properties of visual neurons in this way. For now, I just want to leave a simple example where you have stimulus and response.
I'm just out of curiosity, can we predict the level of noise as a function of the past history in the stimulus?
That's what my second half of the talk is partly about. But there's ways to do it, and none of them are good, and I like to think my way is pretty good, but it's something that people are interested in, I should say. But the past history, the stimulus figures in as well as what the stimulus actually is. But anyway, so you can measure information between stimulus and response, again, by deciding what your stimulus ensemble and response ensemble are. So in this case, In this particular example, I decided my stimulus words are length 3 frames, and then my response words are separated by some latency and they're actually half the width of a frame, and I discretize two spikes into a one and a one at that frame. You can look at these as a function of parameters, and for example, I show the mutual information as a function of latency here, just for this model neuron. And you can see that the mutual information between stimulus and response, given a stimulus word of 10 and a response word of length 2 with half resolution. Anyway, it peaks at about, I was wrong, it's like 18 milliseconds. So that's probably a good latency. But you can vary all these parameters. But the point is for this talk, I just want to say I've somehow calculated joint probability distribution. Now let's interpret it. So these are the parameters I'm going to use, that latency at these things. And you can enumerate the stimulus-specific information of visual stimuli. And since I have a length 10 word, there's 1,000, 2 to the 10 different visual stimuli. And the one with the highest specific information is this on-off response, which is what I knew the neuron, since I did a model of the neuron, that's what the neuron will respond best to. Second runner-up stimulus is something that's an on-off with the last bit different, and so on down the road. And then you've got this big mass of stimuli down here that the neuron both doesn't respond very well to, but also don't have very much specific information, stimulus-specific information. Just in comparison, and this is very much like that two-dimensional example I showed you before, but I'll tell you why in a second. But this is the specific information of visual stimuli. This is the measure I said was wrong to apply to stimuli. And actually, this specific information, there's a big mass, this big clump right up with the highest specific information. And so the stimulus with the lowest specific information is the stimulus that had the most stimulus-specific information. It's this on-off response. And then kind of out of order are the other stimuli down by the bottom. Why does specific information flip stimulus-specific information around? But what's going on here? Remember, specific information tells you how specific information of a stimulus tells you how much the stimulus told you about the response. How much did it reduce your uncertainty in what the response was going to be? So most stimuli that the visual stimuli that the neuron will respond to do not elicit a response. So if they don't elicit a response reliably,
there's a problem here, right?
Yeah.
Which is that you started with a framework in which you have this list of responses, which is just some abstract thing. And now as you're trying to talk about a particular neuron, you're sliding into a language in which a response is actually spiking and no response is not spiking.
I'm sorry.
Actually, right?
But
of course, that's the intuition why people point to the peak of the tuning curve, right? It's because they think ones and zeros are different. Right?
Yeah, but I slid into that terminology maybe inappropriately because, in fact, I don't make any, I may, my only assumptions were because I had a response word length of 2, that there are four, I'm sorry if you can't see this, I'll just describe it, that there's 4 possible responses. 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. Oh, yeah.
So yeah. There's no such thing as eliciting no response, right? You have to elicit one of them.
This is a response right there, 0, 0. So, yeah, so I didn't really mean to slip into that. Yeah, so not a response is a response. And actually, when I was writing this paper up, I had the same problem with just writing the paper, even though I was thinking a lot harder than I'm thinking now. So Bill pointed out that basically I switched the terminology, but in fact I'm not making any assumptions about which of these 4 responses are better or worse. I just measure how much they reduce the uncertainty in the stimulus distribution.
So presumably what's going on here is that most of the time the cell doesn't fire at all, so the most likely response is 0, 0, and that's with, I don't know, 80% probability or something, and then when stimulus A occurs, there's a 50-50 chance that it'll actually generate a spike, and so your uncertainty about what the response is has gone up.
That's right. So when the neuron actually fires a spike as a result of a stimulus, it does so unreliably. And so actually it will, a particular stimuli that caused the neuron to spike, reduce or increase your uncertainty in what the response would be. So the those responses are down, those stimuli are down at the bottom of this specific information.
So symmetrically, do you include no stimulus as another stimulus?
Well, in this case, all stimuli are just trains of black and white squares. So they're also like ones and zeros.
So if I don't see anything, that's like another stimulus.
In this case, you're
zero, zero, zero is when nothing happens.
Yeah, in fact, as the experiment goes, you usually have kind of a gray screen as a neutral stimulus, and then zero in this case, or white, would be a bright flash, and black would be a dark flash relative to the.
We don't imply no stimulus.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, no, in this case, you're always showing either a black or white square over time, 128 per second and so on. So for the course of the experiment, you're sampling 1,024 different length 10 words, and I consider all of them in this. So
the lesson here is that the things that neurons do most reliably is not spoken.
Right, but if we were to, and we
so
could.
If you start trying to talk about, one, if you talk about the whole set of responses, you could ask how much of the information is being conveyed by the spikes versus the spaces. But if you insist on making something specific, there's some sense in which the spaces will be preferred because they're extremely reliable.
The spikes are inherent.
Well, again, let's remember. The thing is
that I suppose the spaces are noisy too, but they're only noisy at the edges, right?
There's a number of this.
So there's some. If you actually look at these things, right? If you look at these rasters, there'll be great swaths through. Even if you do hundreds of trials, there'll be big regions in which there are simply no spikes.
Yeah, but what I'm saying though is that because I think it's important to back up here is what I'm saying is that that the first question you asked, which is maybe the lesson is that no spike is a good response, that there's probably a way you can summarize the joint probability distribution to ask that question. But the question I'm interested in is what stimuli are best encoded by the neuron? And I'm suggesting a measure that summarizes the joint probability distribution in a different way to get at that intuition. And there's other questions you can ask that might be appropriate to use other decompositions, or maybe decomposition doesn't make sense. But the point is this is a way of taking a multidimensional stimulus ensemble and getting something out of it. And in this case, this goes along, what you get out of it with specific information goes along with kind of your intuition about what my neural model was programmed to do.
It's a very basic question. How do you define stimulus? What is the length?
In this particular example, and you can vary this however you want, I'm using actually a length 10 stimulus word. I did a bunch of different lengths, and I saw that this pretty much captured everything that I could tell.
So if you go the other way around, which is response specific information, I of R actually.
I specific of R.
Yeah. So then you have four distributions.
Mm-hmm. They tell you which responses are most informative. I had to calculate those to get this quantity. So I think the 1-1 was the most informative. The 1-0 and 0-1 were about equally less informative, but still informative. And the 0-0 was not so informative. I think it might have probably been a little negative, but I don't remember.
So how much do things change if you change the length? I'm just asking because if I do an analogy with, say, speech, I guess there are some neurons that may be responding to a sentence, and they also respond to a word, and they respond to a vowel, for example, but they respond differently.
Yeah, well, because we can talk more about this, but let me just say that you got to choose your stimulus and response ensembles correctly using this particular method. It just so happened that there was a temporal kernel that went into this neuron, and the time is about 8 or 9 frames. So I knew how to design it right in this case, but I'm kind of talking from maybe a perspective of when you've already measured the neuron correctly, and now we're gonna analyze the mutual information and the decompositions within. But there's a lot to that whole method that I mean to kind of get across. So now I'm going to finally, in my remaining negative time, go into just a particular example with tuning curves. And I bring up the cricket circle system as just an example of a tuning curve. And still, I'm really talking about generic tuning curve examples. But in this case, you have four neurons. I think they're interneurons. So you have primary sensory neurons, and they feed into the interneurons. There's four neurons in the circle system that encode wind direction. So you have one stimulus parameter, wind direction. And they encode other things too, but we're just looking at this one stimulus parameter. And the reason I'm using this particular example, one of the big reasons, is that this is one of the few papers that I've seen. And I haven't looked at all the literature, and there's hopefully a lot more. But it's one of the few papers I've seen. Well, they did a lot of analysis on it, but in particular, they measured not only the tuning curve, but the variability in the response of the neuron as a function of the stimulus. So in other words, you have a tuning curve of a neuron here, and then you also have error bars on the response. And they even fit the tuning curve to functional forms and fit the noise to functional forms. And the idea is that for a particular neuron that's tuned in this case, well, you would say its peak firing is at the zero angle here.
Why such weird angles?
Huh?
Why such weird angles?
This is just how the neurons were. So one neuron is tuned along this direction, one is on that direction, and so on. But it's arbitrary. But actually, relative to the neuron's head, there's one neuron that is tuned to that direction. So I call that direction zero. But so this is it's basically the noises fit well with a Gaussian curve that has slight dependence on angle. And the other four, the other three neurons are tuned at 90 degrees off. So it's a simple example. We have basically all we need to calculate a joint probability distribution. And remember, the question was peak or slope. The neurons at the peak. Does this neuron with this tuning curve encode neurons at the peak the best? I mean, stimuli at the peak, or at the maximum slopes, or near the maximum slopes. And here, just because it's a kind of cosine tuning function, the maximum slopes are actually close to zero, the zero firing rate.
But it's unfair just to look at one neuron. This guy has four neurons.
Yeah, so
it has to be an ensemble.
Well, it is an ensemble, but we'll consider one neuron first, and then I'll just show you a little bit about four neurons. But really, I'm interested, like, you're recording from a neuron, what's it encoding? And that's really the question. This is a generic example. And so you can basically take the joint probability distribution. I showed you that nice multicolor plot before. But you just do it and you calculate SSI directly. And this is what you get. It's the yellow. So this is, given my definitions, this is what tells you what stimuli are better encoded, what stimuli are worse encoded, right? So it seems like it's encoding the slope.
But
I'll show you that in a little while. I didn't do Fisher information until pretty much yesterday, but I'll show you that.
Similar or something very different?
Very different.
Very different.
Very different. So notice, though, that the peak is not at the maximum slope. And then also that you also have a little peak at a local firing rate. So it's actually kind of a weird curve in a way. Although it does give an answer given our definitions.
You're not saying that the insect has only four neurons? No.
No, it just
lots of neurons.
There's four interneurons that encode wind direction,
okay.
I would say. And they're somewhere in the back of in its butt area. Yeah. To be technical. Yes. And you would get slightly different answers if you did a different stimulus ensemble. But this is assuming that you have equal distribution of all stimuli. So we can demystify. Sorry about this. We can demystify this curve by looking at the underlying information responses. This is something you wanted me to do for the complicated neuron. But in this case, it's very easy to enumerate all the responses of this neuron. Is that here you have the normalized firing rate, So one is at the peak of the maximum firing rate, the maximum average firing rate. So because of noise, you can actually have firing rates that are higher. So this is the specific information of the as a function of firing rate. So this is how much each response tells you. And remember, you can this is actually much easier to understand, because you can look at large specific information, areas of large specific information, and that's basically where you have a large reduction in the uncertainty of the stimulus, which means this is really where there are few stimuli corresponding to a particular response.
Can you just comment how we should interpret this, those beats? Is it possible to relate them to something observable?
Well, so let me try, and then you can comment. So why is that first peak there? That's actually because that's where the tuning curve slope is highest. At these low firing rates is when the slope is the steepest, which means that's where few stimuli correspond to a given response, right? But of course, the fewest stimuli, of course, you would say, the slope is steepest at zero firing rate, but that there's actually all these responses that lead to zero firing rate. So actually, these responses, the information of these responses, is quite low because it could mean any untuned stimulus would lead to that response. So you see that peak, and then why is that peak over there? That's because actually firing rates much greater than one are most likely resulting from stimuli near the peak. So intuitively, these are the, well, I keep on saying intuitively. Anyway, this is the specific information of responses. And this goes together to give you, this, because basically you look, the stimulus-specific information is averaged over responses associated with a stimulus. So you average over, when you're here, that's the responses leading to this stimulus-specific information at the peak. And you can see it's kind of a average over multiple responses. And then the responses at the peak, and you can see it's a local maximum because the hump is here and you go up from there. So actually you can fully explain this curve by that curve plus these conditional distributions. And so then the next question is, this cricket was, the tuning curve reported was in actually pretty ideal wind current velocities. So you could do something like decrease the wind current, and then all of a sudden you get a lot noisier tuning curves.
Could I just ask, if you're just looking at firing rates, could you determine the magnitude, the sign of the angle?
The sign? You mean whether it's on the left or the right?
Yeah.
No. Because you can see the tuning curve right there. A firing rate could correspond to either side. Yeah, you either need more than one unit, but the thing is that the information quantities don't matter that at all, because you can equally consider half of a tuning curve, and that reduces everything by one bit, but the information, because both quantities, both uncertainties are reduced by one bit, the information stays the same. So it doesn't matter for this measure, but for other measures that'll matter, and you need an ensemble or something to resolve the ambiguity. So anyway, when you increase the noise, what happens that actually a couple things happen, that different responses become more informative. This is kind of the intuition I presented many hours ago. I apologize, but basically non-tuned stimuli have more noise, which leads to more ambiguous responses at low firing rates. And then finally, you have...
Is this stimulus noise or response noise?
This is that's a great question. I'm doing the simplest possible thing. This is just from the joint probability distribution, which means if I present a stimulus many times, I can look at the response distribution. And so it's anything in between the stimulus presentation and the measurement of a response. So I'm not being specific in this model. So it could be anything at this point. And I could talk about ways to have different noise conditions. One way is by decreasing the wind velocity to something that the wind hairs don't respond to as well. Then you get more response variability. So anyway, now you get to the situation where I said, in high noise case, you might imagine that high firing rates stand out more. And that is the case. You can see right there. And so when you put this all together, at three times the noise that Tunis and Miller reported for their ideal, in the ideal wind conditions, for the three times noise conditions, you actually have a stimulus-specific information that peaks at the peak of the tuning curve. So you get this transition between going from maximum slopes at low noise to peak at high noise. And
so at very high noise, it just becomes flat, is that right?
No, I think certainly you can see the magnitudes have decreased, but you start losing, at very, very high noise, you lose all information, yeah, and it does become flat. So you can imagine this all starts to shrink up.
So where is the transition?
I think still the higher noise, you still have infinitesimally more information, but I haven't looked at that. That wouldn't be really a transition. That would just be everything flattening out.
In this view, you don't have things like phase transition, like in physics, right? You don't have shock transitions between different regimes and so on.
Yeah, I would hesitate to call this a phase transition.
It's just a small change. It's slow.
Yeah. You could say it's kind of like a first-order transition, but...
This high noise is high additive noise,
it's a function of one parameter. You go from having three peaks to having one peak, then that occurred at a point.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
This is high noise of additive noise, not
multiplicative. This is fit from the data, which has an additive and multiplicative component.
The amplitude of the noise was dependent on the angle.
Yeah, it was dependent on the angle, but it also had an...
Right,
an independent.
Right.
Yeah. And let me just say, with regards to that, is that you can actually do this with any noise model. You can do Poisson noise. You could do constant noise. Yeah. So the point is, you get a transition no matter what. It just happens at different noise levels.
So the transition is not dependent on the signal dependent noise, if it's additive. Constant.
If it's additive, multiplicative, you get it wherever. But there's, of course, not exactly the same point. I was actually shocked when...
No, I don't think it has to have a transition. I mean, I can change the noise model to make the peak. There's lots more noise.
That's like a Poisson model, yeah.
It
actually...
I can make it more noisy than Poisson. I can square amplitude noise instead of a square root of noise.
Yeah. I'm not convinced, but I could be convinced that you could pick some weird noise model that would not give me a transition. But for the model, you get it in almost every case I've looked at. In every case I've looked at, and I'll just quickly go through this. And actually, let me I'll just say this really fast, and people who are interested can stay and talk about this more. But you can, another way of evaluating how well a stimulus is encoded is by looking at the reconstruction error given a decoding method. And the idea is, if you have a particular stimulus that's presented, it can lead to some responses. And each response, you use an estimator, such as maximum likelihood or mean squared error, to guess what the response was. And so then you can look at the mean squared error average overall responses. So this is explicitly looking at how a decoding mechanism works. And it's looking, using a metric, on the fact that you have more of an error when your angle's farther apart. And I just put some of this together. And this is what the maximum likelihood reconstruction error looks as a function of noise. And the simple example is that the transition doesn't happen. And I've been kind of interested in why it doesn't happen.
Why isn't there a time dependence in any of these? And you just use a fixed time interval?
Yeah, this is all just where I define my response to be a particular number of spikes in the bin. And I'm just looking at the joint probability distribution. So there's no time in it. Maybe front and then back, yeah. Ben,
how does this? You had a question and then you didn't get to the Fisher. He asked the Fisher information. Does that agree with this?
So I'll show you the Fisher information in the next slide.
All right.
Yeah, Ben, do you have one?
Just go back a slide, I'll take. Sorry. I may have the wrong idea, but big picture-wise, this is basically saying, I think, if you're a little man in the head, what you care about is if a neuron is firing a lot or not at all. Is that right?
This is saying, yeah, well, this is saying I'm looking at the response of a neuron and what can I learn from it? And what stimuli can I learn about?
But, yeah, so if you're asking what do neurons extract from other neurons, is this other neuron firing or is it not firing?
Well, that would mean if there's just a straight line as a function of normalized firing, right? That increases.
Well, I don't know what the other neuron does. Maybe the neuron's as smart as me, the next neuron down. And maybe it's not. And so this is just saying the information that's available to that neuron. Whether it uses it or not is another question. Is that right? So the maximum likelihood, the one that has the least error never transitions to the peak, and it's because of this little dip there. And the reason for the dip is because if you invert the tuning curve, a zero slope translates into an infinite slope, which means putting a metric on this space gives you a large error for just any small increase in responses. So that's why maximum likelihood doesn't give you the same information, because the mutual information doesn't say one angle versus another angle. It just says, I know it's these angles versus those angles, whereas this does. So
on your 1x plot, there's zero marked beginning of the response, or is that where it first becomes non-zero? Is that what
you mean? You know, I did not tell you this, but I'm using a half a tuning curve, because the whole point is reconstruction error is very sensitive to the metric you put on the space, and if you have that one response can lead to your prediction of two different stimuli that are far apart. Any of these metrics don't work anymore. So it's very important that you use, in this case, half a tuning curve or population. And so now I'll just jump to the Fisher information. I plot the Fisher information as a function of, I hope this isn't too dark, as a function of 1 over the error, the mean squared error of the maximum likelihood estimator. And I just did this last night. I was trying to understand what Fisher information is. Zero at the peak of the tuning curve. It kind of goes up and then comes down, kind of where the tuning curve hits the C. And you can look at 1 over the what the maximum likelihood estimator does. And the Fisher information is supposed to bound any unbiased estimator. You can see it's not bounding it here. And you can't see, but it's not bounding it out here. But that's because the maximum likelihood estimator is biased. And I don't really know how to construct an unbiased estimator, but I didn't know what the Kramer-Rao bound was until recently anyway. So if anyone has an idea of how to construct an unbiased estimator so we could actually use Fisher information on this case, it would be great. But otherwise, the Fisher information is about as meaningful as my knowledge of it.
Why should the estimator be unbiased?
That's just the Kramer-Rao bound. I don't know if it's a theorem. It's basically for it to be for Fisher information to bound the error.
But for the brain, it's just the other way around. The more you know in advance, the more prior you have, the better.
Yeah, but that's not what unbiased means.
Yeah, this unbiased has this mathematical definition, and Fisher information is really a statistical parameter estimation.
You mean bias by the prior, that's a different thing. So the idea is I give you data, you estimate, that's your theta hat given the data. Now I average that over all the different bands I could have given theta, and the average of theta hat should be theta, if the data was conditional theta. That's what unbiased means. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a prior over theta.
Yeah. So just to not sell the slide short, is what this is predicting is that you'd have the least variance in your mean squared error, kind of somewhere in the middle of your tuning curve as a result of this. That's both as a result of Fisher and 1 over the mean squared estimator. The Fisher information though goes to zero at the tuning curve peak, which means that there's no bound in your variance. On an unbiased estimator.
But this is without noise, right?
What?
This
noise?
No, this is with noise.
You're doing distribution of signals and responses with the noise, so it's not just a tuning curve, it's a tuning curve which is spread out.
The Fisher information actually is.
And then you differentiate and then take, you know, differentiate the log and take the square and you still get zero there.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, yeah, I should I should tell you that I just simplified the noise model a little bit to do this calculation easily, but it certainly applies to when you don't simplify the noise model, it's just harder to do, and you get the same basic idea. So I always thought the Fisher information was on crack because you get a strong response from a neuron, and that doesn't constrain your stimulus ensemble at all. It was weird. But we see that actually even a maximum likelihood estimator will not have infinite variance at the peak of the tuning curve, and that's because you can't make an unbiased estimator. Or maybe you can, but I couldn't. Anyway, that's Fisher. And what I did is I looked at a population, and let's talk about this afterwards. But basically, I looked at the single neuron contribution to the information, because this happens in the context of four neurons. And just the quick answer is, you can calculate the total mutual information, and then you can look at the contribution of one neuron. And for low noise, it's at the, now there's many slopes, but it's kind of near the maximum slope. It goes a transition to where the tuning curves seem to intersect, and then it goes to the peak. And so it's a transition, but it actually happens at even higher noise levels. And presumably, as you use more neurons in a population, you wouldn't, noise would become less and less of a factor. And the contribution of an individual neuron would be relatively minuscule.
So this is a population of neurons tuned to different angles, but they don't talk to each other, right? They're independent.
Yeah.
Operators.
Yeah. And it's assumed. They actually hadn't made simultaneous recordings of these neurons. But
if they talk to each other, presumably.
Yeah, that's something that Bruno, who was here last week, was interested in. You could get more or less if they have correlated.
How could you get less?
Yeah, you could get less if they're just if they have correlated noise. It has to do with drawing out. I can show you this afterwards. But this isn't. That's what Bruno's been working on, not me. I was lucky to understand it. So anyway, what I want to get to ultimately is back to the motivation that originally you had a way of characterizing the function of a neuron, which was very simple. And it led to results that seem to make sense. And you basically say, well, what neuron causes, or what stimuli make the neuron to fire? And that's what a tuning curve is. What I'm suggesting is that just by measuring a tuning curve and its variance, you actually lead to different interpretations of what stimuli are important. And so that it's actually very important to consider both when you're looking at what's encoded in a simple tuning curve. And then this is just a brainstorm about like an experiment that would test this. What does it mean if noise level affects the tuning of neurons? And these are experiments that you could do where you have visual stimuli with a lot of random dots going in random orientations, but some of them are correlated. And a monkey has to discriminate which direction the dots are moving in. And usually this task is set up as just discriminate between going up or down or left or right. But in the ideal world, the experiment would be where he has to discriminate any angle. So you have neurons in MT, area MT, which respond. And this would give them kind of a more variable response. This would give them a less variable response. And what this would predict is if the monkey's ability to distinguish angle would correlate best with different neurons, depending on the level of noise. But you know, there could be other things that the nervous system does. Since sensory neurons operate under a range of noise levels, measuring a tuning curve, you know, might actually you want to keep track of the noise. But people haven't really measured tuning curves in multiple noise levels a lot. And if anyone knows any data where there is, be fun to play with. But in the case of, say, retinal ganglion cells, they see at very, very low light conditions. And actually, some people say pathologically low light conditions, your surround goes away. So your receptive field actually changes. Your tuning curve changes. And presumably, it's to to preserve the function of the neuron. And you could also imagine if the neuron's encoding different stimuli the best, that you might actually also want to change downstream targets. But anyway, so that's some food for thought, and we can talk about any of the details I skipped over towards the end afterwards. Oh, and I'd love to run the my receptive field stuff by people at some point too. So thank you for all your time and attention.
Is that a fact that your receptive field can change depending on the stimuli?
Yeah. That's actually very well known.
Well-known fact.
Yeah. And that's actually something that I'm interested in from my second work. I'm interested in looking at that.
So Dan, I can't think of an experiment which is exactly the one you suggested, but there must be something close to the auditory system, because I mean, for a long time people have known about this asymmetry of the tuning curve as a function of frequency, and so people realized that frequency, I mean, this is back in the 60s, people realized that that frequency discrimination at high frequencies, where it's based entirely on, presumably based more on rate versus location along the cochlea, has to be, when you do the discrimination, you're dominated by this sharp edge on the high frequency side of the tuning curve.
Yeah.
And so, presumably that means that I can disrupt your frequency discriminations by putting masking noise, by adding noise at frequencies which are above the frequency you're trying to discriminate.
Basically by making...
Now, it's a little harder to decide whether that effect is bigger than if I added it right on top of the signals. But it's certainly true that if I apply the noise, you know, above, then I have a bigger effect than if I apply it below. That's for sure.
Uh-huh.
So the asymmetry of the tuning curve is reflected in an asymmetry of masking, as it's called.
Huh. So I wonder if I could use that.
So that... And that's almost the experiment you're talking about. I mean, you actually want to correlate individual neurons with behavior. That's a little harder, of course, but...
Well, that's an ideal case. But yeah, I should look into that. I mean, just as a... This is really like an interpretation of a simple quantity, and I wonder if ultimately getting an interpretation of what's really going on might be delving deeper, but it might be a good place to start.
So just a very basic question. So from this picture of information follows that the sharper the slope, the better the discrimination is.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I mean, if the system was designed to discriminate, all cells would have like a delta function like receptive fields, right?
The thing is, they've even asked this question, and the thing is Fisher information, I think, from the, what I'm getting out of it is that it's really only meaningful in a population. Yeah, but in a Well, let me just say the Fisher information is meaningful in a population context. And in a population context, they've actually done studies about how wide you should make the tuning curves, you know, when they're all overlapping. And actually, it seems to be better to actually have a lot of wide overlapping ones in the context of a population than having very sharp ones. That's for Fisher information. That has to do, I think that you basically get cooperativity. You get multiple neurons representing one stimulus, as opposed to if you had very sharp ones, then you'd have not very many neurons overlapping.
You have more noise rejections, is that?
Yeah, you basically have effectively lower noise levels, because you, assuming that the noise is independent. If the noise isn't independent, and this gets back to a question earlier, then you can actually saturate, and you don't gain as much from knowing one neuron. But in terms of MLE, or a maximum likelihood error, I think you would be good at discriminating two particular stimuli if you had a really sharp tuning curve. But as you make it wider, you can discriminate more, not as well, from a perspective of something like that. And I think that's a lot more clear to look at the Shannon information in that case, because it's looking at how well you can discriminate the whole ensemble. And in that case, there's some optimal width as well. Any other questions?
So did I get it right? You just wrote, when the Fisher information and MLD estimator, there was no dependence. I don't know if you used actually the same noise model that you used for the other metric. So were you actually using the same noise model and there was no dependence on the noise level?
Well, no, there is dependence. But actually, so I cheated because I just wanted to see. So I can get all these same transitions that I showed you in the cricket with constant noise. So just pure additive noise. And that made it easier to do this calculation fast. But the calculation still depends on the noise level. And it depends just as a multiplicative constant. Basically, the Fisher information goes down proportional to the variance of the noise.
Okay, but the shape of this curve doesn't change.
Doesn't change at all.
It's like a one-way sigma
squared. So that's why your empirical prediction just applies for your metric. But if this is the right metric, your prediction would be, you wouldn't have these different neurons being used for different levels of noise based on your proposed experiment for monkey physiology.
Uh-huh.
That would just hold if this was the right metric or the right way, whoever is looking at these neurons is doing the test, you would not predict that different neurons would be used. Different neurons with different tuning curves would be used at different noise levels. Is that correct?
Yeah. In fact, I have another plot where if you imagine a population, they all have peaks at different places. And it depends on noise level. So if you were listening to one neuron, which was firing a lot at one noise level, you might want to listen to a different neuron at a different noise level. It's another way of looking at the same thing. But
I'm thinking, is there are these different metrics you have. You have these and this one you're proposing. And then the question is, which one is the brain using to...
Well, yeah. But what I mean, really specifically, it all depends. All these metrics mean something. And it really depends on what I really mean. And what I'm really trying to look at is what is one neuron doing? When you see a tuning curve, what does that mean? And what I'm suggesting what I'm trying to suggest, but also feel to my heart, is that this metric really isn't appropriate for looking at this question. There's no unbiased estimator, which means the Kramer-Rao bound doesn't hold, which means it's not even linked to the error in maximum likelihood estimation. Secondly, it's not clear that making an error, this error squared, the mean squared error of an estimator is the right thing, because that's explicitly a decoding question, which puts a metric on how well you do by angle. The information tells you something very well defined. Whereas if I were to give you a tuning curve that had two peaks, the maximum likelihood estimator, or especially the mean squared likelihood estimator, would pull out the peak of the tuning curve every time because it's symmetric.
Okay.
So,
are you familiar with Pouget's work at Rochester?
Yeah.
So do you have any comments on how does that compare to that? I mean, their approach I think is more along this, right?
Yeah.
I remember that paper, right?
But they...
populations.
Yeah.
I know that as far as I know, an analysis where you look at a single neuron and you try to ask for this neuron, if I can look at the pattern responses, which is the stimulus that is most informative or most, which is the stimulus that this neuron is encoding for?
Yeah.
I don't think that they have answered.
No, they're asking a different question, but actually, I mean, I think that's an interesting discussion question because something that their paper has is that they say that the measure that they use, I think we're thinking about the same paper, it's the one with the V1 neurons.
I think so.
Yeah. The measure they use, they say it's really equivalent to a lot of other metrics if you're pulling in more than 100 neurons. Now, V1, I mean, that kind of presumes that V1 is trying to give a whole ensemble input to someone that's actually trying to decode an angle. And what I think is much more likely that you're not trying to discriminate an angle in higher visual areas, but you're trying to use some function of input, which doesn't involve pooling multiply spaced tuning curves that are all focused on the same receptive field point. And when you start talking about a general calculation like that, that higher order visual areas have to do, I would say using a metric that says that angle discrimination is important, it might not be wrong, but it's hard to imagine that it's correct. And as a result, you wouldn't want to put a metric on your space of stimuli. If a given response encodes this angle or the angle at the opposite side of the tuning curve, that might still actually be a good response, even if these two stimuli are far apart. So in V1 in particular, I don't think that these measures are the way to go, because you're not trying to decode using a population of V1. I think it's very different in motor areas where you have tuning curves, but that leads to an output, which is basically decoding the neural signals.
So are you implying that individual neurons in V1 are sort of independently meaningful neurons?
Well, I'm implying that you can look at a V1 neuron, use these techniques, and see what's meaningful to them without worrying about other things.
But that's what I'm asking. That's what I want to ask at the very beginning, but it's at the end. At what point you can assign function to individual neurons, and at what point you decide that it has to be collective? At some points, the response of individual neurons is only interpretable as part of
Yeah, I think, and that's kind of what this discussion is getting at. And the answer is, if you know what the neuron is being used for and what it's doing,
right,
then it's very easy to answer that question.
Right. So I think that's where, if you define a task, then we can objectively, right? If we define the task. So I mean, ultimately, some of these metrics, I mean, if you know ahead of time that this neuron is used for a given task, then you know how to objectively evaluate it, right?
Yeah.
What is the part of, given that you define a task? So the idea here is that you're not defining a task and you're trying to, right?
Yeah, you're task-independent sort of way. You're trying to get a meaningful answer by making your question as general as possible.
In a way, it seems not as general as possible, though, because you have to, you're assuming a given distribution on the input. So you're saying what stimulus is best encoded by this neuron given that my stimulus space has this distribution?
That's correct. And that's important to all the even if you ask questions about virtual information, all these things are in the context. When you ask how much have I learned about the stimulus by looking at this response, mm-hmm. is in the context of the given field.
Right. And
that's
the question
always
is,
very important to remember. That
right.
It's always in the context of the given distribution field of the stimulus.
Right, and then the question is there some reason why we should be interested in one stimulus distribution as opposed to another?
Well, you could ask images, for instance. You can say, well, what is the distribution of edges oriented in different angles? So do I live in a world where vertical edges are more common than horizontal edges? Is it symmetrical, uniform in those stimulus limitation? So, this is a little bit related to the discussion we're having on Aristotle's talk about the importance of using stimuli in your experiments and process reproduces the statistics for that feature in the natural world,
right?
In natural images or naturally auditory scenes or whatever.
Yeah.
Because the answer will depend on that.
Right.
And also, I would just say that kind of question gets thornier as you have a more higher dimensional stimulus space. And in the case of bar orientation or wind direction, you can answer that question relatively easily. You know, do you see a natural uniform distribution of orientations in the visual world, or do you not? But it's very important to remember this, especially when you start getting into natural scene statistics.
It seems like sometimes neurons might be tuned not for.
Yeah.
Depends on the animal you're looking at. Insect doesn't care about the horizon, so the pitches are the same.
Right.
Human,
right. Well, it's not only the natural scenes, but the natural scenes as filtered through the very early stages.
Flying dragonfly probably does care about the horizon.
Dragonfly probably does. Fly probably does not, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, are you okay with the official information?
No, I'm still not. I mean, I have two questions. First of all,
Suppose
what we're doing is the following. We have the stimulus